Welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. Coming up, we talk to Andrew Zweck, one of the most influential men in international live music, and also James's uncle. Andrew has worked with Pink Floyd, The Rolling Stones, Queen, The Who, David Bowie, Elton John, The Police, Bob Dylan, Depeche Mode, Madonna, Justin Bieber, to name just a few of the huge acts he has acted for as a promoter or agent. He worked alongside Bob Geldof on the famous Live Aid concert and partied with the likes of Freddie Mercury. It's a remarkable career for a man born in Blyth in country South Australia. After finishing university in 1974, Andrew went backpacking through Europe and took a job as a stagehand at Hammersmith Odeon. He never looked back. With some smarts, ambition and a bit of luck, Andrew found himself front and centre for a golden era of music. He talks about his pathway, unforgettable moments, as well as his toughest times in the music business, the business model of music back then and now, the crazy cash global stars can earn on tour and at private parties, managing tour logistics and egos, and so much more. It's a fascinating story. Enjoy our chat with Andrew Zweck.
Andrew Zweck, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Very pleased to be here.
How is it that a boy from Clare ends up in the music industry in the UK?
I did what many young Australians do, the backpacker circuit, the gap year experience.
And what years are we talking?
When I finished high school I finished Adelaide University in 1974, and I went to London, and it was very easy to go to London in those days because you got a 5-year working holiday permit, which is, 5 years is pretty good compared with what they give today. The Commonwealth and the diggers meant something in the UK in those days. That's all faded now. They don't even know where Australia is anymore. It's all about the European Union, although that might soon change. Australia may come back into the British orbit, but it hasn't been for a very long time. And so in 1975, all the planes that went from Australia ended up in London. And also it was a rite of passage for young people to go to Europe and to, we're a nation of Europeans in the middle of Asia. And so the trek to visit the motherland, I'm sure there's hundreds of thousands of young Australians still doing that same thing today. I know for sure there's plenty of young British kids when they finish high school, they do their gap year.
And did you love music then? Like, did you go thinking, I'm going to have a crack at this, or – what was going on in your mind?
The signs were there. I can't say that I went specifically to have a career in the international live concert business, no. But the signs were there. In my last year of the Adelaide University, I was the social activities officer and I was putting on bands, which was all my friends. My friends were in bands and I was paying them $120 for lunchtime concerts, which was a fortune in those days. I was taking the union funds and keeping my mates alive, playing concerts. And the commencement ball at the Adelaide University in the beginning of 75, I was the producer of that. So the signs were there that I was going to be an organizer. And I knew from an early day, I was never had any talent to be on the stage under the spotlight, but I thought just in the shadows next to the spotlight wouldn't be too bad.
And how did you, get your first opportunity to actually earn some money in and around the music industry?
In 1975, there was lots of opportunity in the music business. It was brand new. It was innovative. It was, creative. It was the early days and you could walk in the door and do anything. It really was in its infancy. So I did the normal thing, what many Australians, young Australians did then, and I no doubt still do today. I bought a camper van at Australia House. I went around for 6 months touring Europe. I came back to London. The winter was coming. What do I do now? Most people went home. And I went to a couple of concerts at Hammersmith Odeon at the end of 75. I went to Bruce Springsteen's first show in the UK. And in that period also, I bought a ticket for Ike and Tina Turner at Hammersmith Odeon. I paid £1.25 for a ticket. I sat in the very back row. And I remember looking at the stage that night and seeing that there was a guy sitting on a box on the stage watching the show from the stage. And I thought, I bet that guy's being paid £1.25 and he's much closer to the pop stars than me. I reckon that would be a good job. So I marched around to the stage door of Hammersmith Odeon that night, knocked on the door and said, how can I become the guy sitting on the box? And it started right there, and it was so quick. Within about 2 weeks, I was the guy sitting on the box, because it was an era when opportunities abounded, and entertainment, live concert business was in just, you know, opening, expanding. Innovative entrepreneurial promoters were taking risks and creating the industry that we see today. It was a very big deal to sell enough tickets in Hammersmith Odeon. It was a very big deal to sell out an arena show in Wembley Arena. God forbid you could sell Wembley Stadium. It was unheard of in those days. So my timing was good. I don't think I had any more special talent than anyone else. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. But I was ambitious very quickly, and I was very lucky. I knew what I wanted to do. Today, you know, many people go a long time in their lives not quite sure what they really want to do. I have my own sons in their 30s. They still really don't know what they want to do with their lives. But I knew in 6 seconds when I got into the music business that it was for me, and it was I couldn't foresee anything more fulfilling or exciting. I thought, this is the business for me. I want to stay in this. And so I was determined and ambitious, and I got lucky very quickly. I fell in with the major promoter in the UK at that time, a guy called Harvey Goldsmith, who had a very successful business for the next 20 years. He was just starting as well at that time. And I could see a career path. You know, I was ambitious. I would go to Harvey and say, Harvey, let me make you a cup of tea. Hold on, I'll park your car for you. Give me that bag, Harvey. I'll run it to the fourth floor promoter's office up the steps at Hammersmith Odeon. And so very quickly I was working as a stagehand. Very quickly I was working as a promoter rep with Harvey Goldsmith, because, I was determined, and I could see what I wanted, you know. And so I think that was the key. I could see the career path. I could see what I wanted to do. I was so enthusiastic about being in this business. And Harvey Goldsmith was the top dog for the next 20 years. And very quickly, I was working with the A-list bands, and something I've been very lucky to do for the rest of my career. You know, I've been in England more than 40 years. I've always worked in what we call the Premier League. In English soccer, you're in the Premier. I'm at the top of the Premier League all my career. I've never had to suffer to go down to Division 4 and work with baby bands and so on. So I've been very lucky in that regard.
What did you love about the business in those early days?
The memory now is that it was exciting. You know, by May 76, I was working with Rolling Stones at Earls Court, the most exciting band on the planet Earth for me in those days. And I was part of the team producing their shows on the promoter side. I was a good organizer. It was fulfilling, and I fell in with Queen very quickly. The next 10 years, every show that Queen did, right up until the last show with Freddie Mercury, which was in August 86 at Nebworth, a big show. Little did we know that night, that was the last time he'd ever play with them. But Queen was a significant band, still doing well today with Adam Lambert, bigger than they ever were. They've got the songs. We were working with major artists. We were working with the Eagles. We were working with Pink Floyd. We were working with Yes was a very big band in those days in the UK. And, I was good at the job, and very quickly was in a senior position as a promoter rep, producing concerts. It came easily, naturally to me, and it was fulfilling.
So let's just maybe go back a fraction. When we unpack what it is that organizing is, when you say you're organizing stuff, like what are the mechanics of what you're organizing? What are you actually having to do?
It's all about experience. You know, it's like any job. Once you learn it, it comes very easily. And so the promoter rep, we in those days we were multifaceted. We would work on the making the deal with the act. We would work on the promotion, the advertising, putting the ads in the paper. We would work on the ticketing, which is how to price the tickets and scale them in the house, how many at the top price, how many at the bottom price. We would work on the production. You know, the band need a stage. They need catering. They need, you know, stage hands for the show to unload the trucks and build the show, all this kind of thing. So today that's very compartmentalized. I see, you know, a different music business is constructed differently today where you have a building full of promoters, but they only know one thing. They only know ticketing. They only know production. They only know marketing. They only know accounting. But when I started, we were all rounders. We knew every aspect of putting a show together. So business was booming. Bands were – it was an era where nobody saw a 40-year career. Mm. I once spoke to Roger Waters from Pink Floyd about what did he foresee when he started Pink Floyd and they first started having success. What was their vision for their career? And he said, well, if we thought it would last until Christmas, we would think we would have had a great run. And that was 1967. And 50 years later, they are still there. Nobody saw that. Nobody thought that this could be a career and a life that it would sustain. And particularly live performance side, which is a business which continues to be booming in, you know, ticket sales and number of concerts continues to grow.
I have had the fortune of seeing some photos of you, let's say, at Freddie Mercury's birthday parties. And like you said, you've talked to, you know, George Harrison's called your place. I mean, there is an aspect of your job that has been that has required you to be very close to some very, very famous people. Are there any sort of stories or moments where you just, in those early days, you thought, this is incredible, this is just amazing, what, you know, the experience that I'm getting?
I've been very lucky to spend my working career close to very talented people. Talented people are different to you and me, ordinary people. You know, they need support to fulfill their talent, and that's what managers do, that's what promoters do, and support them. I guess I've seen pretty well everything. Most of them are, you know, regular human beings who are, you know, deserve their success and treat people very well. And, you know, I think, well.
What about, are there any parties that you remember?
There was an era in the 70s when record companies were riding high and bands were selling piles of records and budgets for parties were unlimited. It was crazy days. They would buy entire clubs just for a party. If you went to Germany, the record company there was some legendary German clubs on the Reeperbahn in Hamburg where the record company would throw a party and buy the whole club and everything was free for everybody. And that era's passed. The record companies don't have any money anymore. Bands don't spend on craziness like they used to. It was, you know, after the social revolution of the 60s, you know, the dark post-war depressions of the 50s, you know, that was gray and bleak. And then the 60s came along and 1967, the summer of love and freedom and music and cultural expression. And the 70s, that carried on into a lot of excess. You know, lots of craziness. I'm sure there's still bands today doing craziness. I'm sure Oasis at their peak were doing equally outrageous activities. But it seems to me that 70s, you know, topped it as regards, you know, drink and drugs and excess and women. You know, there was plenty going on.
In terms of, okay, so to give us a bit of context, you're talking about these unlimited budgets and so forth. From one of these enormous international acts, what's like a ballpark kind of revenue figure that a big tour could bring in?
Then or now?
Then.
Hard to remember them then, but, you know, I was working for the Eagles by 1977. I was on tour with the Eagles in Europe, and 1978, they did a tour of stadiums in America. I was the stage manager working for them. Even the crew had a private plane. Admittedly, it was an old Viscount with propellers. However, this was pretty wild stuff, and they were selling 1 million records a month. At that time, they were riding high, They, you know, Hotel California was a huge success. They already had a greatest hits album out. And money was awash. You know, if you were at the very top, and that continues today, if you're at the very top, you did very well. Although in those days, the money wasn't the driving force in the beginning. You know, a lot of bands, it was the creativity, it was the songwriting, it was the adventure, not every decision was driven by, oh, how much money we're going to make, which has absolutely dominated and taken over the business today. Today it's dominated by greed. But in those days, it was a different era, a different approach, and
more creative spirit,
you know, if we have another hit album, you know, where will our career go? Will it last? And there were no tour accountants when bands went on the road in the early days. You know, they just used to, the manager would collect a whole bunch of cash from the promoter and they'd run around with a briefcase and they'd put a few receipts in it. And after a 3-month tour of America, they'd open up the briefcase and say, okay, what's left? This is what we divvy up. There wasn't like the rigid accounting. And you know, that briefcase was used to spend on everything for the tour. There wasn't even credit cards in those days, you know, and it was far different to what it is today, where it's very regulated and dominated by lawyers and accountants and entirely different business.
So you mentioned Harvey. Who were some of the other sort of bigger names behind the scenes, sort of as we're heading towards the late 70s, early 80s? Who else was on the case?
Well, there was, you can look now and see an era of international promoters who were the first ones in, who basically invented it. People today look at the big pop concert in a football stadium and they say, oh, it was always done like that. Well, no, it wasn't. Somebody was the first guy to figure it out, to say, I'm going to take the risk. I think I can sell those tickets. I think the ticket should be this price. I'm going to regulate my costs. You know, I've got to provide the stage and the sound and the lights. And in the 60s, they started, and the 70s was their heyday, and there was a crop of the solo entrepreneurial promoter. Harvey Goldsmith was in London. In Australia, you have four of them and they're still there and they're still holding on. Paul Dainty, still driven today in 2017. When I bought a ticket for Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin in Memorial Drive in Adelaide in 1973, when I was a student, Paul Dainty's name was on the ticket and he's still there. The first generation is holding on. They're not giving up. You also have in Australia, Michael Gudinski, Michael Chugg, Michael Koppel. All of them started as students in the early 70s, and they were truly entrepreneurial, seat-of-the-pants risk takers. I'm sure they can tell you many stories where they were struggling to pay the bills at the end of the month, where they were doing, like every corner shopkeeper, putting another concert on sale on Monday to pay the debts of the band that they owed from last Friday. And I'm sure there were some weeks when there wasn't the money coming in on the Monday. And so that era of those individuals was recreated around the planet. In America, there's a legendary promoter in the West Coast called Bill Graham, and there was a similar character in New York called Ron Delsner. And these were the guys who dominated their markets and invented and created the business. And in the beginning, and the business changed dramatically. In the 60s, when the Beatles toured, the promoter got the lion's share. There's still two promoters working in England today who promoted the Beatles. They're both close to 80, Barry Clayman and Danny Bittesh. Danny Bittesh still, I do Mark Knopfler. I'm the agent for Mark Knopfler. I promote Mark Knopfler. My promoter in the UK for Mark Knopfler is Danny Bittesh. Danny Bittesh, if you go in his office, he will show you the contracts for the Beatles in 1964 for the UK tour. That he was that guy. And Barry Clayman, the same in, works in Live Nation in London, still goes to the office. He's got a poster, he's got a contract of a wall on the wall, Walthamstow Town Hall, 1964. The gross was £100. The Beatles got paid £10. Barry Clayman got £90. So it was 90% of the promoter in those days. But then this changed dramatically, and this changed with Led Zeppelin in around 1972. Peter Grant was the legendary manager of Led Zeppelin. And he is credited with changing the structure of the business to give the true value to the artist. In the past, promoters just dictated to the artist the terms. Beatles never got big fees for their shows. They were paid flat fees. And Peter Grant invented the percentage deal, where he would go look at a football stadium, work out the gross, you know, the big touring, the first band really to pack up a whole bunch of trucks and go on tour around a whole bunch of stadiums, one after the other, was Crosby, Stills and Nash. And I think it was 1971 or 1972. Could have been Neil Young in that. Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. That's where the touring, big outdoor stadium show model was invented. Led Zeppelin cemented that. And Peter Grant, who was has a reputation as a bit of a hard man, invented the percentage deal whereby he would say to the promoter, I don't just want a guarantee. I want to get 90% or 80% of the house. You know, what's out there? The artist gets the lion's share. And so the first dozen years of the music business, the bands didn't get that. But from the 70s, they started to get that. The band's power and ability to grasp their just desserts, their greater share of the gross income developed then.
So you've come into this industry at a point when it's beginning to explode, and you're building relationships with people as you go along who are going to prove to be this layer that invent an industry. And the picture that I'm getting is one where you've just got a very important phone book, and your business is your ability to ring people up and cut a deal.
Correct. It's all about relationships. You build a name, a reputation. I think every piece of business I ever got is because somebody knew me or I knew them. I've never had any success in cold calling. Although the nature in those days, that was absolutely it. You were the top promoter. You had a good name. The bands worked for you. That was your market. You were the dominant operator in that market. Today it's changed entirely. It's been consolidated into the power groups who pay big money. The power of the artist has exponentially increased over the years because live concert business is booming, because consumers are happy to pay high ticket prices, because the emotional experience of going to a live pop concert can't yet be replicated on a computer or on an iPad, but I'm sure it will one day, but luckily not for the moment. You know, each year there are more shows by more artists, higher grosses, higher ticket prices, all the venues. You speak to any venue. We used to do this many shows. Now we're doing double that many shows. Live concerts, despite high ticket prices in Australia in particular, are booming. And so today the picture is that the artist has tremendous power, and the artist can hold itself out to the highest bidder. And the stronger the artist, the greater the money. And so there's now two big consolidated power groups dominating worldwide touring. One is called Live Nation, the other one is called AEG. And they go to an artist now and say, I want to buy your worldwide touring rights, and I will pay you up front for them. I will pay you for the next 100, 200, 300 shows, and I will give you a huge down payment right now. $10, $20, $30 million now, sign with me. And so the advisors behind many artists, the agents and the managers, they quickly realize, I can buy a new house this month if I take a nice commission on a big fat advance payment like this. And this is a direction that the business has gone in the last decade. Consolidated power groups, much, much tougher, dominating the buying by paying crazy money, huge risk. And they don't have to make all the money back on the profitability of the concert itself. They have other revenue streams, such as the service charges and booking fees from the tickets, sale of the tickets. You know, Live Nation and Ticketmaster are the same company.
Oh.
And so consumers are paying 10 or 15% generally on average worldwide on top of the ticket price. And so this is where if a big power player like Live Nation has content and has lots and lots and lots of artists, then okay, maybe they've paid too much for individual concerts and the concerts aren't selling and they're not making money on the profitability of the concert itself. But they are getting substantial revenue streams from service charges and booking fees, and also from sponsorship. And, you know, there are other revenue streams associated with concerts, and that's where they make the real money, and that's why they can pay the pop stars, top dollar. Any new emerging pop star that looks like it can have a long career can hold out for really high guaranteed offers of huge amounts of money up front, long-term contracts, huge advance deposits. It's the independent promoter is struggling now. His relationships are counting, but he's being outbid by Consolidated Power Group buying worldwide. And Live Nation have done that. They've opened in many, many countries around the planet, and they can go to an act and say, hey, we can service your worldwide touring needs. And the agent loves it. No longer does he need to deal with a dozen concert promoters in Europe and an individual promoter all in every city in America and another dozen guys across South America. He gets one buyer walking in, giving him a big fat check saying, I'll take care of the world for you. And the agent thinks, how easy is this going to be? And I can quickly move on and make some money somewhere else. So it's very attractive for artists, agents, managers.
Is it fair to say that the continued growth of profitable live concerts kind of offset what's happened with record sales in terms of streaming and that pie shrinking?
Undoubtedly. The decline of record companies can be certainly better documented by people than me, but artists don't get paid for their music. Very difficult to earn any substantial money from online. Streaming in particular pays very, very little. And so live touring, the decline of their income from sale of recorded music has been directly compensated by the rise in what they can earn from live performance.
I'd love to jump back and for you to talk about your experience and involvement with Live Aid, because I know that you were right in amongst it.
Live Aid, when you look back, you would think, it was a world renowned event, and how could anyone not want to play that show, and how easy was that to put together? But it wasn't the case. It was very, very difficult to put together. Bob Geldof and Harvey Goldsmith spent many, many months struggling to get the idea off the ground, to convince bands to play it. And
at what point were you sort of briefed about it, and what involvement did you have in the early stages?
It took place in July, and the first meeting started in February, and it was very, very hard to convince artists that it was real. And Bob Geldof was very clever, as you've seen. He's a leader of men, and he would play a game with different pop stars to convince them. He would fudge a little bit on who really was in the show. He would call David Bowie and say, oh, Elton's doing it and Queen is doing it. And then he'd call Elton's manager and say, oh, David Bowie and Queen, they're definitely in. And it took a lot longer and was much more difficult to put together than anyone would, looking back, would think. How could any artist refuse to play it? But there was a lot who refused to play it. There's even some whose name's on the poster. I haven't seen the poster in recent years, but we'll have to check. But I think there's some artists whose name appeared on the poster who didn't actually appear because their manager was warned, saying, actually, it's not really going to happen. It's not really going to be successful. And you shouldn't get involved. It's this guy, Bob Geldof, is out of his depth. It's not really going to come off. But it was a great example of what one guy can do. Bob really was the individual who was the catalyst for everything that happened there. And I will forever admire him that as an example of what, we all think, oh, what will my voice count and what can I do just as one guy? But that's a tremendous example of one voice does count and one voice can push and cajole and enthuse others. And, that stands the test of time and history as an unbelievable event. And it was more primitive those times than you think. In 1985, it certainly wasn't email. There wasn't mobile phone, was a long way off. There wasn't even fax in 1985. When we would have to convince a band to perform, we would have to write it all, type it all out, and send it on a motorbike messenger over to the manager to say, hey, this is how it's going to be. It's all going to be great. Nothing will go wrong. Make sure sign up, please. We need you on the poster.
What about the actual logistics of the concert and the stage and the simulcast? And, what do you remember from that time?
I remember lots of meetings at the BBC where they kept shaking their heads saying, can't be done, can't be done. Yeah, we're going to do a satellite link up. We're going to have one song from Philadelphia and one song from London, and then we'll cross to Phil Collins on the Concorde. And a lot of people moaning and looking at their shoes, shaking their heads, don't know if we can do that. But in the end, a tremendous team effort. They all pulled together. As I've seen many times in my career, when you think, hey, we're in trouble here, we don't quite know what we're doing, but the collective teamwork, the collective experience, the collective resources comes together and solves a lot of problems. There was no model of how to do it, of how it had been done before. And I remember panicking a week before the show that we really didn't have a plan. We didn't really know how we were going to produce the 22 acts in London. But we ended up, using a revolving stage, and it looked very good, and it stands the test of time if you look back at it now. But technologically, it was on the seat of its pants. It really was. It was so much going on. People were so tired. Technology was far more primitive. There's some bits of Paul McCartney where you can't hear him because, they plugged the blue microphone into the yellow channel, and people didn't get everything right that day because it was so much going on. And you had your certain allocated number of minutes. I think it was 20 minutes was each act slot, and then you had to get off, and then we were going to go live to Philadelphia, and it all had to run simultaneous. Somehow it did, but only because of a room full of people, of collective people, clubbed together and figured it out. For sure, 1 week earlier, there was a Bruce Springsteen series of concerts in Wembley Stadium a week prior, and it finished on the Sunday. And then the following Saturday was Live Aid, and Bruce Springsteen left his stage there. He didn't join, actually. He was playing somewhere else that day, but he said, I'll give you the gift of my stage. I'll leave it behind as my donation. And we all sat there at the end of the Bruce Springsteen show and said, okay, we've got 6 days for this thing with Live Aid. Who's got a plan? We didn't even have a running order. All our managers are arguing, my act must finish. I've got to be on first. I'm not going to play after him. All this kind of thing was going on. And we panicked. There was a group of us there. We better get one of the world's experienced stage managers here. And I remember burning the phones that night around the planet, looking for all the great names of all the experienced production managers, stage managers who'd done big international touring pop concerts in the stadiums, of which there was only about 5 in the whole world. Every single one of them was unavailable. They were all in Philadelphia. Every one of them was with a band in Philadelphia. And we said, drop what you're doing, fly in. We don't know what we're doing. We need you in London. But in the end, it fell to a group of us who were there, and it was a great team effort.
Looking back on your career, what are the hard moments or the hard concerts or tours that even maybe make you cringe now? Has there been anything that's gone wrong?
Interesting experience with Paul Simon, who wanted to be the first artist to go into South Africa when the cultural boycott was first rescinded. You two are too young to remember that there used to be a United Nations cultural boycott on South Africa up until 1990, I think. You weren't to go there because as a protest against the apartheid regime. And this was rescinded in like December 31st, I'm guessing 1991 or 1990. And Paul Simon said, I want to be the first act to play in South Africa now that there was a significant political change. There was still a white government, but they were letting Nelson Mandela out of jail, and there was change. And okay, United Nations, artists can go there. The new South Africa is changing. But there was a group in South Africa who were opposed to Paul Simon coming. And so we put the tickets on sale in some big rugby stadiums, Ellis Park and the big cricket grounds, thinking many, many thousands would flock for this new era. And we got it totally wrong. There was a political group who were opposed to Paul Simon coming, saying, country's not ready for it yet. I still remember their name, Azanian Youth People's Organization. They, in fact, put 2 hand grenades into the promoter's office. That was pretty scary. They were successful in frightening the public. That became front page news, and they kept issuing press releases every day saying, South Africa is not ready for this. There's not enough change in this country. We don't welcome Paul Simon. He must leave. There will be bloodshed and violence at this concert. We're going to stop these concerts at any cost. This was very tricky.
What was Paul Simon saying at this point?
He's saying, hold me 25 seats on British Airways tonight because we're leaving South Africa. who's going to tell me to stay here? And of course, when they put two hand grenades, we left the promoter's office at 7 o'clock. We got a call at 9 o'clock from the police saying, you better come down here. Your office is in pieces. If you've ever looked in a room and seen two hand grenades.
Oh, so it actually did explode?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, was it just they placed a warning sign?
No, no. They threw them through the window and they explode. Makes a hell of a mess, I can assure you. It's frightening. It's sobering. Takes a lot of cement the next morning to cover that up, all those pockmarks in the wall. And, of course, this made front page news. Promoter's office bombed. Anti-apartheid group says, we will stop these concerts at any cost. The ticket sales absolutely stopped. So that was the time when I was totally out of my depth. I didn't know what to do. Paul Simon saying, should I stay? Should I go? And tough times. In the end, he stayed. We played the shows. They weren't commercially successful. The white people and the black people had never mixed together ever at anything. So we got 100% white people came. They were frightened.
What about a step back to even get the infrastructure? I do remember a story you once told to the luck that you had in just getting a stage up in South Africa, because that hadn't been done in a long, long time.
They purchased one, an old second-hand one from Europe, and put it on a boat and sent it down there. So that worked okay.
But who did you call to kind of make the first steps in getting the tour organized?
In South Africa? Assie van Wyk, who's ended up having a 30-year career as the biggest promoter in South Africa. He's joined Live Nation today. He was a songwriter, and his name kept coming up, the white man with the black heart. It was a songwriter who produced all the black acts, and I'd met him, interestingly enough, I'd met him a year prior when Eric Clapton wanted to, this is the days you can't play in South Africa. So Eric Clapton says, I want to go to Africa. I can't play South Africa. What can I do? So I got him some gigs in Zimbabwe, and we played in Botswana, and we played in Swaziland, and we played in Mozambique. Mozambique was still at war, 15 years of civil war. You could hear the guns at night still. And 100,000 black people came to see Eric in Mozambique, paid $1 a ticket. There was only four white people at the front who were from the American embassy. But the reason that they came, the reason 100,000 locals came, was not only had the country been at war for 15 years, and this was one of the first things of first social events where they could, get out and celebrate, but we put together a bill of five of the top South African artists from 15 years previous. So I find this songwriter in Johannesburg called Attie van Wyk, and I say, Mozambique's been closed since 1974. Who was the biggest pop stars in South Africa prior to 1974? So he found them. We put them on a 737. We flew them over there. They put their name on the poster, and 100,000 Mozambicans came to see Sifo Mabuse, Steve Kakana, PJ Powers. I can't remember the others. And it was a huge success. So I had a good experience with Attie, that promoter, and then I – a year later, Paul Simon wants to come. Okay, do you want to start the fledgling live concert business in South Africa? And he said, too right, I do. And it's proved to be a very successful career for him and his son. They're still the dominant promoters today.
I guess another thing, looking back over all these years, everyone has their favourite live music moments, but I'd imagine there'd be some special ones for you. Can you narrow it down to a couple that have stood out, whether it was you sitting on the box, side of stage, something special happening? What immediately comes to mind?
The most fun I ever had with the band was with Queen. It was just such fun, the personalities and the characters of those great years, 76 to 86. The smartest bloke I've ever worked with is Roger Waters, Pink Floyd's songwriter, visionary, invented the stage show that we see today, the Pink Floyd spectacle. Every artist that you see today has a huge LED video screen behind them with images on it. Go back into history of live performance. Who was the first guy really doing that? And you go to 1967 in the UFO Club in the Roundhouse in Camden, and you'll see Pink Floyd, four nameless musicians, no spotlights, and a projector putting images onto the wall of the UFO Club, and the band playing anonymously, and it's all about the immersive experience of the visuals and the sound. So Roger Waters, that was his thing way back then, and he's continued that to be innovative and groundbreaking in everything he's done. I did a charity show with George Harrison. That was a thrill because he's a personal hero. And he did call me at home one night in my kitchen, which I always will treasure that moment.
Where were you sitting when you took the call?
By my kitchen window. Hello, it's George. it was a funny show. It was a charity show about people bouncing up and down in about 1992. It was an odd one. One of the few things he did in the out of the Beatles in the years before he passed away. He didn't do many in the UK, and that was one of them. Another moment I regret, a moment of regret, is that I was the promoter of Johnny Cash on his last show in the UK in the Royal Albert Hall in, I think, 93 or 94. But I never even went to the show, and I came to regret that later because I became such a huge fan of all his Rick Rubin albums that he did in the final 10 years of his career. And so I've searched for that poster for years, thinking I want that one on my wall because that was very significant. Working with Bob Geldof, you know, the inspiration of the Live Aid, what it became and what it meant to people and how it changed. It invented a charity era. You know, it was the next 10 years. It was followed by numerous multi-artist charity shows working for a cause. That's a trend that's faded now. You don't see that much. You see it, you know, once a year for some super disaster like hurricane relief in New York or something where the pop stars turn out.
But you still, I know you probably couldn't comment, you still get the feeling now, though, it's as much a PR exercise as it is a kind of, you know, we truly believe in a cause.
Yeah. Now, there's benefit for everybody when they go on the church.
What about I mean, you were involved with the Michael Jackson world tour.
I have a consultancy with AEG who did that. I did a few Michael Jackson shows along the way.
Where did they rank in terms of production and experience?
Yeah, he was an amazing talent. It's such a sad story that he couldn't sustain. Lack of a strong manager, I guess, would be part of it. You know, in the period when Michael Jackson was doing great work, he had a strong manager and he was doing creative things. The guy Frank DeLeo from Sony Records. And then in his last period, there was no manager. And his work and his life deteriorated, I would say. So that's a sad story. That you know, clearly so much talent. He sold out those 50 shows at the O2 in London, which he didn't play. You know, he passed away before he could play it. And there's often been rumors about how many people kept their souvenir ticket for £100 and didn't go for a refund. I think there was some, you know, that substantial pool of money still sitting there somewhere.
What have you learned about managing egos over the years?
Serve the artist, give him what he wants to keep him happy and creative and working, and then we all have a job.
Can you explain the genesis behind Ishkul and the ski resort that gave you a call one day?
There's a ski resort in the Tyrolean mountains in Austria where they had a visionary. The local mayor said, I want to put on pop concerts and make my name as an international destination of exotic events. And so for 25 years, that village has been paying for world-class pop stars to go there. And this is a trend which is growing. The private show, the corporate show, the special event, where artists can get, you know, crazy high fees. Russian oligarchs have ruined the market. They pay a lot. The United Arab Emirates.
You had an Amy Winehouse story, didn't you, with one of the Russian guys?
Yeah. I've done a few for Russian clients where they wanted an artist for a party or whatever. And you know, I did an Amy Winehouse show, which it was in a period where Amy wasn't at her best and was.
What does that mean for you? Like, how stressful is it?
I think people understood what was going on with her. You know, there was a lot of good people around her and they couldn't help her. You know, they really couldn't help her. I know quite well the people who were around her, her manager, her agent, the team that were with her, her tour manager, they did everything they possibly could. And, you know, later people said, oh, they drove her to her demise. They worked her too hard. It was just a cash cow. That wasn't the case. She was an addict who couldn't help herself, and they tried everything. They really did.
So when someone comes to you and says, I want to book Amy Winehouse, are you sort of saying, no, no, you don't? Like, don't
correct. Yeah, no, I warned the client. I said, she's unreliable. She's not performing well. You can look on YouTube yourself and can see the last couple of months what her performance is like. I'm sure it's still on YouTube today. There's some terrible shows where she clearly was out to lunch. But they like that. There's an element of people who want to see the car crash, who think, hey, I want to see this act who's clearly in trouble, because I might be there on the last ever show, and you know, I might witness the car crash. So
did the show happen?
Certain appeal. Yeah. Now the show happened. It was in Moscow, the opening of an art gallery. Amy thought it was a birthday party, sang happy birthday, but. The band stopped her halfway and said, Amy, it's the opening of an art gallery.
So coming back to Ishkul, what year did they first approach you and who was the first act?
It started in 95 and Elton John, and we've had a pile of major artists, you know, Rihanna and Katy Perry, Bon Jovi, Bob Dylan, Sting, piles of them. And it makes the name, you know, that's the client's. You know, the use of the pop star to build the brand of that village. It, you know, use music to sell your message, to get your consumers to recognize you. Music is a great medium. So that's a very big business now, private shows and corporate shows for pop stars. And Russian oligarchs paying too much have destroyed the market. There was a day when I could find $1 million meant a lot to a lot of artists who would turn up. But now they've been overpaid so much that a lot of them won't get out of bed for $1 million. They think, you know.
So what sort of figures are we talking for some of the bigger ones?
You know, I've heard of $5 million for a one-off private show for people in Russia or the south of France or some of those kind of markets. Definitely several $1 million for major A-list names. Sure. They can command big fees to go play for somebody's party for 300 people. And there's plenty of people with money to pay it.
So while we're on that, this will be the last of my individual corporate experience, but the Sultan of Brunei, what was the arrangement and how did that come about?
It lasted for 3 or 4 years in the middle of the 90s when it was the Sultan of Brunei's brother, Prince Jeffrey, and it was his kids. And we had a range of artists there, private shows for the birthday parties of his kids. And
so it's not the Wiggles, it's who were some of the acts that attended? Can you remember?
Michael Jackson came twice, Whitney Houston, you know, Elton John, Sting, Celine Dion, Mariah Carey, at least 15 more that I can't, not coming off the top of the head. This was good business, you know, they would get good fees and it was, you know, the private show business, it's been around quite a few years now. And some of them were public shows, one or two, where the citizens of Brunei were invited, but mostly it was for 400 people in a badminton court.
What about, changing mode a little bit, what about the mechanics behind a world tour? So if you took a Roger Waters tour, can you give a scale of how many days he would play, how many days off he gets, how do you get shows in different cities? Can you just give an overview of some of the major parts of a world tour? Or a North American tour?
As artists get older, they do less shows per week because they get tired and they can't. The singing is tiring. You know, Mark Knopfler, he can play 6 nights a week. But, you know, Michael Jackson could, every time he sings, he needs 2 days off. And there's a lot of artists now in their 70s. I work with the Rolling Stones. Got to have 2 days off after every performance.
So it's 2 days off, 1 day on.
Do a show, 2 days off. Do a show, 3 days off is a pattern now for some. There's a lot of bands. You know, Mick Jagger's 74 years old. Roger Waters is 74 years old. And they run around and do an energetic performance. And if you've ever tried running and singing at the same time, try it. It's tougher than it looks. They need their rest. So this is a trend I've seen. Less shows per week, but the grosses have commensurately risen, so we're still making the same income per week. And
how many shows would they look to do? let's say, for a North American tour?
It varies. It varies. Roger Waters just did 63 shows in America. Rolling Stones do runs of 14 or 15 shows, and then they stop. Then they've had enough. They go home. And most artists will take as many shows which are on offer. And it varies, really. It depends how many tickets can you sell? Can you go to the B and C markets in America? America is very lucrative, very rich, high ticket prices, and so many cities. You know, in Australia, you've got 5 or 6 cities. Well, you've got, if you don't count Adelaide, I guess, really, as a major market, but you have 4 cities in Auckland. In USA, there's 54 cities. There's a very, very large market. And, it depends on the offer you get from, and, you know, the income that you get, and then you tailor your tour accordingly.
And what about stages and kits? Like, how do you get all the equipment from one to another?
Very sophisticated touring production industry has grown up, extremely sophisticated compared to what it was when I started. The technology and the number of people doing it and the number of skilled people. There are specialist trucking companies, specialist PA companies, lighting companies, video companies, and always buying new equipment. There's tremendous innovation in these areas. Lots and lots of skilled technicians. Business is booming. Trucking companies, there seems to be, scores of them, and they've all got fleets of truck. And any pop show now, I go to see a few pop shows in London. You go to Katy Perry and Ariana Grande and Selena Gomez and Rihanna, and you need 25 trucks of stuff to compete, to be on par with your peers. Madonna, 30 trucks of stuff. When you take, it's a couple of sound, trucks of sound, a couple of lights, a couple of video. What's the rest? Stuff. Sets, scenery. I just booked Justin Bieber in Europe. Very successful. 50 shows in arenas in Europe. Sold every ticket. 24 trucks. And I went to the show, and each song, there's a different set and scenic number. One song, he's bouncing on a trampoline in the 50 feet above the crowd in the middle of the, middle of the arena. Down comes the chain motors, and he jumps onto this trampoline. Another one, he's playing drums on a tower 40 feet high. Well, in the industry, these are called gags. Each song has a gag, and everything must move. The sound, the video screens must move. The tower for the drum kit must emerge and go away. The trampoline must appear and go away. All of these gags are $1 million each to construct. There's this fabulous construction company dominating the industry in Pennsylvania called Tate. You can't move in there. There's 1,000 people in there building pop shows where every artist is trying to outdo each other. This is one of the consequences of the big fat offers from Live Nation. When an artist is given up front $10, $20, $30 million for their tour and think, wow, where can I spend this? How should I spend this? And there's very clever design people at Tate in Pennsylvania say, how would you like to do this wild and wacky idea that nobody else is doing? Rihanna's not doing this. Justin Bieber's not doing this. Katy Perry, you should be the one to do this. Drop out of the skies while singing, tracking along, all kind of set and scenic madness. So business is booming. And I was speaking to a rigger the other day, who's responsible for hanging all this in the venue. And he said, we're at the limit. We're at the limit of what we can achieve in one day, 30 truckloads of stuff loading into a venue. We go in at 4 in the morning. We're hanging 80, 90 tons from the roof of that venue. This is arena level, which I've been lucky enough to work at. There's a lot of bands playing in clubs, but let's talk arena level. And we can't go any bigger. We've reached the limit. We can't physically put more stuff in there in one day. We can't physically hang more stuff from any building in North America than what we're doing here. So I don't know I don't know what direction that's going, but technology is going leaps and bounds on new tricks which pop stars can afford. And I've seen some of the presentations from these clever designers that take these little Vimeos. They show the pop star that they spend a lot of money on these little Vimeos, and the pop star looks at it for 3 minutes and says, wow, can I have that? Yes, please. Where do I sign?
You've spoken about the evolution of the industry. How have you personally had to adapt and change?
If at all.
It's more competitive. You've got to fight for your corner. Everyone's role has changed a little bit since the consolidation of the big power groups offering so much money. I mean, money dominates everything. I don't think I've seen any decision in the last 5, possibly 10 years that wasn't made on the basis of money. The old thing about what's good for the artist's career and how can we sustain and build long-term doesn't even come into it. It's how could we refuse that money? We better take it. So there's lots of bands have taken big money. The ticket prices were too high. The concerts didn't sell and it didn't serve their career well. So that bit has been difficult, but it's not going to change. Money is everything.
How does then a business like Live Nation, I hope I'm not taking too much liberty here, but then purchase a business like yours? What are the mechanics behind that? What are they purchasing?
The talent, you know, an experienced promoter who knows what he's doing is a 10-year learning curve. An experienced agent who knows what he's doing, that's a 10-year investment. You get some kid out of university who comes to you at 22 years of age, he really isn't going to do anything until he's 32. So if you can bring in someone who's experienced, it's worth paying for that to get instantly. You know, it's a specialist industry with you know, specialist knowledge, which, as I said earlier, is all based on experience. It's just like any job that anybody does, once you've done it for a few years, you know what it is, you're good at it. Same in this business. But you still got to have good judgment about what shall the ticket prices be and have I booked this band into the right venue and can I try to balance the books?
One of my last questions before we get to, it'll probably be back to Punter's Corner because we're sort of in that Nuffy music mode. Well, you should be anyway, Andrew.
We've got through a few Punter's questions already.
But this is around one of the more iconic images of Pink Floyd. We've got, I don't know what they were, smokestacks or something. And drawn between them was an inflatable pig. Mm. What happened? And how did that come about, that picture?
It was a Roger Waters idea. It's an iconic image from 1977 Animals album, and it was Battersea Power Station, and it was Pigs Might Fly was the theme. And they went down there in a cold January day, and they put the pig up there, and the first one dislodged, and then they went the second day, and they had to have a marksman with a gun in case it you know, flew away and disrupted the
Heathrow. Who had the pig? Why did the pig, inflatable pig, even exist?
Oh, because that album was, if you listen to Animals, 1977, Pigs, Dogs, Sheep, that's the songs. And so that's the connection, the theme of the pig. And it's remained an iconic Pink Floyd connection ever since. And it did fly away and they did have to shoot it, but they did luckily get the one photo. This is the days before Photoshop, when album covers were actually set up, staged, and photographed. And, you know, a clever group called Hypnosis, Storm Thorgerson, did a lot of work on that. You should look at his book of the album covers he did. He's passed away recently. But it's part of the era of people who invented it for the first time. And that's an enduring image. You know, Roger Waters uses that image now. He plays he's coming to Australia this year in February 17 and 18, February 18, and he's playing a selection of songs from Animals, and the pig features heavily. So it's lasted the test of time.
Right, well, this is to finish the interview, Andrew, we tend to do a bit of rapid fire.
Right.
So the rules are here. Not really rapid. No, it's generally not. But anyway, the rules are you can't sit on the fence with any of the questions. And Andrew's going to start.
No, you don't have one for the first time.
No, I've got one. I've got favorite destination to take a band where you enjoy yourself as much as the band does.
Russia. The bands don't like Russia, but I love it.
Why?
Because it's the heartland of the enemy. You know, I grew up in Australia in the '60s, and it was the age of the Vietnam War. We had the yellow peril from Vietnam. We had the red threat from Russia. The communists were coming to get us, the combined orange threat. You had to live through it to know. You had to live through it. You know, the youth of today have no idea. This was quite serious. They were coming to get us, and we were fed the propaganda that the Russians were out to.
So you're behind enemy lines. That's why you love it.
Steal the babies from their beds. And when I first went to Moscow and stood in Red Square in the snow in the winter of 1989, I was like I was walking on air. Here I am in the heartland of the enemy. And you realize that, yes, Russia had put the first man into space and that they had nuclear weapons and so on, but the country was no threat at all. They couldn't even build a car that worked. And the people had no interest in, a nuclear threat of coming to find us in Australia. Although, of course, 1963, the Cuban Missile Crisis, Khrushchev and Robert Kennedy, that was serious. There really was nuclear war there, and that pervaded, you know, my childhood. I was 9 years old at that time. So I love Russia. I love the Russian people. I love the Russian language. But every American band I take there say, hey, this is totally overrated. How quickly can we leave?
My question is, the one album that you constantly go back to?
Any Little Feat record. Never got sick of Little Feat since introduced to them by Mickey Eckert in the early 70s. Love that band. Lowell George died in 76, not been the same since, or 78. But never tired of Little Feat records. Love Kate Bush records as well. I'll listen to Kate Bush, so any Kate Bush album, anytime. Her show, she didn't tour for more than 25 years, and she did some shows in London about 2 years ago. It was a sensation. I buy everything that she puts out.
Most obscure venue for a concert that you've had to organize?
India, waste ground. Any piece of wasteland in India, Mumbai or Bangalore, you put up a stage made of sticks, literally. The legs of the stage are branches of trees roped together, yet they make it work. There's no venues, and you find some land which is just total waste ground, and you put up a fence and build a stage of sticks and bring in the generator, and that's where you do your concert, and it works. It's a great experience.
Okay, now let me articulate this one. So I'm giving you the opportunity to put on your own concert for yourself, 5 bands, unlimited budget, and you can resurrect the dead. I want you to pick those 5 bands and tell me the location of where you would put that concert on.
We can edit out, some think time.
Have you think time?
Greatest
when I was a kid.
But hypotheticals. Shouldn't it be the Australian cricket batting order or something like that?
Rolling Stones in Hyde Park. You know, you can't top that. It was one of the great things ever. Bruce Springsteen in New Jersey, in the Meadowlands. I went a few times in the 80s, which was the peak. Little Feat Anywhere, my favorite band of all time. Kate Bush, Hammersmith Odeon. I'll go back to that show. If she performs for a month, I'll buy a ticket for every single night. That was a sensation. Roger Waters Anywhere, definitely, the cleverest stage show designer of them all. And I think I've answered them all, haven't I? Is that it?
That's
But I did a few shows with Bowie. I mean, we're in trouble with the demise of the great artists, you know, Bowie and Prince and George Michael. This is definitely a trend inevitable demise of the major players that we have now. And so Bowie, did a few things in the 70s and 80s. So 80s was terrible. Look up the Glass Spider Tour, one of the worst tours ever. Don't bother with that one. But he did this black and white show in 1978, which is a sensation, which I remember very well. And then he didn't work that much in later years. You know, you didn't see him that much in the UK.
Why come back to Australia every 2 years?
Family ties are strong. All the, my wife is from Adelaide.
My brothers are here. All her siblings are here. Our parents, when they were alive, were here. And it was a great place to go for Christmas, get out of the English winter. Family ties have been – family is very close and ties are very strong. I've lived in London for 43 years and I guess I've come to Adelaide 30 of those years, come for a visit, I would guess, that many times. It's an attractive destination.
My last question, which has two parts, summarise in a sentence your experience in being involved with the Gallipoli production, and the other aspect of the question is your opinions and feelings of doing the Spurs White Hart Lane final. Was it a concert or event?
Yeah, primarily I'm an agent, an artist agent, and I was a promoter, but I'm also a very good event producer, and I worked with the team at Gallipoli for 10 years, culminating in the 100th anniversary in 2015. And it's freezing cold. government spends a great deal of money on a dawn service that lasts 45 minutes. Very important that that event is run impeccably, that there could be no criticism, as you know, politically sensitive in Australia. I put together the Turkish team. You know, there were some event producers in Australia who run it, but they need local infrastructure. And I know the concert industry professionals from Turkey who bring the physical infrastructure, you know, the generators and the sound and the lights and the seating and the toilets. And as the years have gone on, the government has, you know, increased those budgets to make sure it works perfectly. And it was very impressive. The 100th anniversary, you know, we'd known it was coming for 10 years and the planning was good and it was memorable and I was very pleased to be part of the team that put it together. But the one legacy of life in London, apart from the appreciation of an Indian curry, is that I've transferred my allegiance from originally West Adelaide and then the Adelaide Crows. I've transferred it to Tottenham Hotspur. I lived in North London for the last 30 years. I'm an avid Spurs fan. And Tottenham are building a brand new stadium and they closed their old stadium after 118 years. They played at White Hart Lane and it closed in May 17 after the final game, which we won against Manchester United. And there was a 1-hour closing ceremony. It's on YouTube. Take a look. It's fabulous. And we, it's simple, but effective to honor the memory of that ground and what it meant to those people. And, as you know, English soccer means a great deal to a lot of people, particularly not only the UK, but worldwide.
And now one of your boys is working for the Stench.
Yeah.
Arsenal.
Yeah. Now one of my sons works in sponsorship and he works over at Arsenal, which, you know, some things you've got to do to make a living. But that's one of my proudest things, being associated with the football team that you pay to go see every week to be part of the behind-the-scenes team to celebrate the closing of that old ground. And I think we're planning something even bigger and better for the opening of the new stadium, which will be the biggest and best in all of London for any domestic team.
Last one from me. What are the key ingredients for world-class talent?
If you've got the talent, you need some luck. I think that there is, it's a question of timing. I worked for many years with Depeche Mode, and I sat one night with Dave Garn on the private jet after the show, which I have no qualms about. Walking up the steps of a private jet after having loaded trucks as a stagehand in my early days. And I said, Dave, why do you think that such a rich crop of British talent was born in the 40s? You think of every act that's internationally made it, Rolling Stones, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Elton John, David Bowie, Queen, Phil Collins, super talented people, all born in the 40s. Why was that so unique? And he said, that's not unique. It's just that they got there first. The 40s wasn't any more special than the 50s, 60s, the 70s or today. There's equal number of people born with talent today. They just got there first. The Beatles in 1962, they got the melodies, they got the chord structures, they got the songs first. And there's finite
It's, you know, the song structures are finite and now it's so much harder to invent them. And so what was the question?
No, ingredients of world-class talent.
Right.
So luck, okay. Timing.
Yeah, so luck and timing. So those guys, the first generation, many of whom are still holding on, you know, Paul McCartney recently played in Australia after 26 years. He's still touring. He's 75 or 76. Now, who's to say he should stop? If he can still perform, you know, Leonard Cohen went to his 80s, B.B. King went into his 80s. Where is it written that anyone should stop? Even though Pete Townsend said, you know, hope I die before I get old. And this, I saw a clip of Mick Jagger the other day saying, I can't see myself doing this past 30. nobody knew it was coming. So it's just, I think a lot of it is luck today. I think that there is, as many, you can see all the talented TV shows, you know, the talent things. Australia's Got Talent and all that kind of stuff. There's plenty of people, kids running around who can sing, who can write a song. And, you know, if 1,000 kids of equal talent throw the mud at the wall, one sticks and 999 end up working at Coles, there's no rhyme or reason that I can tell you why the one sticks. If I knew, I'd own Richard Branson's Necker Island. You know, it's luck, it's timing, it's determination. I think the best is, if you've got talent, the best advice for me is, you've got talent, enjoy it at whatever level you can. You may not have success as an international recording artist, but you can be a singer or a guitar player at home, in your local school, in your community, whatever, and find fulfillment and satisfaction. Exploit that talent, but it's so, so tough. I don't know what the formula is for success, to, you know, for commercial success.
Andrew, thank you for giving us such a long period of time. I've known you for basically my whole life as a family member, and so it's just been amazing to sit with you and sort of talk about your work and talk about the things that you've been involved with, and in terms of groundbreaking and being opportunistic and being ambitious and being in the right place at the right time. It's probably a summary of your life too. So, mate, really appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to our chat with Andrew Zweck. We have plenty of interesting interviews in the bank and many more to come. So subscribe to Rooster Radio, and if you like what we're doing, leave us a review on iTunes or your favourite podcast player. And connect with us at roosterradio.biz. We'd love to hear from you.